Good afternoon and welcome to this lunchtime webinar from Higginson Strategy. I'm Alex Davies, an Associate Director here at Higginson. Everyone on our panel and in our audience will have heard that totemic Michael Gove phrase, "I think people are sick of experts." Well, we disagree, and in fact we polled the public in June after the first peak of the coronavirus pandemic and found that 70% were now more likely to listen to experts. We subsequently launched the Expert Bureau as a platform to allow journalists and policymakers fast access to relevant voices as we go forward. Today, our expert webinar asks, what is the future of UK healthcare? We know that over the past 30 years, NHS hospitals have come under pressure from staff shortages and rising demand, while government funding hasn't kept up with rising costs in the system. Meanwhile, living through COVID has seen the NHS reinforced in the public mind as the UK's foremost public institution. Social norms, working practices, and economic policies have all been redesigned to protect the NHS, which has been at the front line of the battle against the virus. So today, we want to explore how UK healthcare will change and needs to change to meet the challenges it will face in 2021 and beyond, from the rollout of a mass vaccination programme to making progress with the elective care backlog and keeping emergency care safe. To explore those issues and more, we're joined by four experts in the field. Baroness Ilora Finlay is an assiduous crossbench member of the House of Lords, working on everything from the Agriculture Bill, the UK Internal Market Bill, and the Medical Devices Bill. She chairs the National Mental Health Capacity Forum and is a professor of palliative medicine. Mr. Richard Kerr is a consultant neurosurgeon and a council member of the Royal College of Surgeons of England. He chaired an independent commission on the future of surgery in 2018, which mapped out the changes we're likely to see in patient care over the coming decades. Dr. Adrian Boyle is Vice President of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine. He's a consultant emergency physician at Adam Brooks Hospital in Cambridge and an honorary senior visiting research fellow at Cambridge University. Finally, Professor David Peters is a former GP. He's Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Holistic Healthcare and a former chair of the British Holistic Medical Association. He also founded the Centre for Resilience at the University of Westminster. Welcome and thank you all very much for taking the time to join us today. So to start us off, can I ask each panellist, starting with Adrian as a practising medic joining us from a hospital, to give us your take on the future of UK healthcare, both in the immediate term and beyond. Adrian.
Thank you. So I was given lots of titles at the beginning, but essentially my job is that I am a jobbing emergency medicine consultant. I'm an ENI consultant who works in a very average hospital seeing undifferentiated patients. And prior to the pandemic, it was very obvious that emergency departments and the urgent and emergency care system is not fit for purpose. Remember, 20 million of us use ENEs each year. And last winter, before the pandemic started, we regularly had delayed ambulance offloads, what we call corridor care, where people were waiting in corridors. This was all due to exit block. And this pressure that we've seen on reducing beds over the years has got now to a crisis point where we cannot admit patients safely. We know that patients who wait a long time in emergency departments to be admitted have adverse outcomes and an increased risk of death. We estimate 3,000 people a year suffer harm as a consequence of long waits in emergency departments. This may be delayed diagnosis, delayed treatment, or even just simple awful things as having a fall off a trolley in a corridor where they're not being looked after. What we saw over March and April and the stage of the pandemic was suddenly these corridors emptied. What has happened now, as workload has gone back into the hospitals and our hospitals have become full and even fuller than they were before, is corridor care has returned. And this is more dangerous because having people cheek by jowl now not only exposes them to risk of picking up flu and norovirus and not being observed properly, it exposes them to the risk of acquiring COVID. There are examples going on throughout the NHS England and throughout the UK where people have caught COVID in an emergency department and spread it around vulnerable patient groups within wards. Our departments are crowded. The cause of this, which is, and you need to understand the cause of why we're crowded, is there aren't enough beds. Now, just this morning, the BBC website reported that since compared to December last year, there are 12,000 less beds in active service. That is 2 to 3 wards for every hospital in NHS England. not only have we lost the actual number of beds, we've also lost the functional capacity of those beds. Because of infection control restrictions, because of the need to ring fence important surgery, it is actually almost impossible to get people into hospital. So our call as a college is that there needs to be urgent effort to increase the capacity of our hospitals to look after our patients. Before the pandemic, we think we were short of about 10,000 beds. We've now lost another 10,000 beds. It may sound delusional to ask for it, but we think the need, if we are to look and run our hospitals at 85% capacity, is that we need an extra 18 to 20,000 beds. That sounds like a lot, but if you consider in terms of the number of hospitals we have, that is probably the equivalent of two extra wards per hospital. And that would have a transformative effect on reducing infection. It is not just about beds. It is also about making sure that people have access to the healthcare that they need. Many people go to emergency departments because it's the only place the lights are on and the only place where they can get adequate access to healthcare. And this is not around personal convenience. There should not be any patient blaming. Royal College is very supportive of efforts by the RCGP to expand the role of general practice. But, and you know, care in the community and pushing care into the community has been an aspiration of every successive administration. But we're going the wrong way. It's hard to get people to be GPs. It's almost impossible to get people to be full-time GPs. But if we're serious about trying to decongest our hospitals, we need to provide people with the access, alternative access to the emergency department. We cannot continue to be the system failure service. Thank you.
Thank you, Adrian. Richard.
Thanks, Alex, very much. And thank you for asking me to be a part of this. I'm going to look rather more in the future, accepting that everything wasn't rosy in the health service before the COVID pandemic. I accept the issue about the beds that Adrian's just described. I think the challenges between health and social care were very significant, and that continuing challenge is something that needs to be resolved in the future. I was involved, as you said at the beginning, in writing or looking at the future of healthcare, particularly surgical healthcare in this country. And I think what we were able to emphasize from that document is that we do have the potential in the future to get to a place where we are able to establish diagnosis early on in patients' pathways. We're able to hopefully change the way we deliver surgery to a much more minimally invasive platform, and particularly a platform where we're practicing organ sparing surgery rather than organ removing surgery. And I also think we have the ability to move to much more personalized care. And I think those are things that we should absolutely aspire to, because it's going to result in better outcomes for the patients. Now, the areas that we identified where we're going to see these changes are clearly in the role of minimally invasive surgery. It's in the use of data and particularly the use of genomic data, the use of simulation and virtual reality, and the use of other specialized areas like stem cells and biointegration. Now, I absolutely accept that this is very forward thinking, but I think medicine as a whole is trying to embrace the digital revolution that we're currently in, that we see in every walk of life. And we want to try and see the benefits from that. However, I also think that it will be really important to focus on other measures. And we can't just look towards technology to resolve the problems that we have in terms of the huge wait lists that we're facing. So population health is extraordinarily important, and realizing the benefits of exercise, of weight control, of diet, of getting rid of smoking, and the impact that's going to have in terms of our ability to get patients through treatments, including surgical treatments. So lower complication rates, better outcomes, and particularly a much greater uptake of day case surgery. I think that we need to understand the huge variation in care that is happening across the UK. And there are areas of excellence, and there are areas where, unfortunately, the treatment delivered isn't perhaps quite at that standard. And we need to try to work on resolving that huge variation. Now, the work that Tim Briggs is doing with the GERF program, Get It Right First Time program, I think has highlighted that enormous variation, even in the uptake of Daycare surgery, for example. So going back to the issue that Adrian was talking about in terms of the number of beds, and absolutely we've seen a progressive drop in the number of beds, but what we haven't seen is that progressive uptake in the move towards Daycare surgery that you might expect as a result of that. I think the work of the Centre for Perioperative Care, and this is particularly working with the colleges, has highlighted the importance of looking at the entire patient pathway when it comes to trying to get the very best for our patients. So it's not just that episode in hospital, it's everything from the preventative measures that take place, primary care, into the action between health and social care at the end of it. And then the last thing I want to say is just to emphasize the need for training, teaching and training, team working, and everything that goes with that. And I think that's really important and needs to be focused upon. We're going to deliver healthcare as a team in the future, increasingly so. And we need to be trained as a team. We need to work in teams. And in that way, I think that we will get much better outcomes for our patients. So that isn't to say that there aren't issues and problems. They were there before COVID. But I think there are also things that we do need to look at for the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. David, would you like to go next?
Yes, thanks very much. And thank you for inviting me to be part of this. So let me just say there are two sides to this pandemic coin. And one of the things that the NHS response has shown so clearly is the overwhelming popularity of the NHS and the crucial benefits of having a state-funded service, especially when you compare to the United States response. And although it's been a very difficult time in hospitals, there's been a remarkable resilience of the hospital services in showing their capacity to adapt in emergency. And we've seen amazing altruism in the community, certainly in the first stage of lockdown. I'm glad to see that there's been a huge government willingness to borrow and spend vast amounts of sums when necessary. We've seen increased online consultations, and perhaps that's a harbinger of the future. And we've seen this rapid innovation in vaccine technology. So there are grounds for optimism for more and better pharmaceutical solutions. And Richard mentions systems biology and personalized medicine. I think the idea of P4 medicine, predictive, preventative, personalized, participatory, which I think Leroy Hood coined at the Institute of Systems Biology, demonstrates a framework to detect and prevent disease through extensive biomarker testing, close monitoring, deep statistical analysis, patient health coaching. So these are all positive signs. But this is against a background of very, very steeply declining nursing and doctor morale, frontline burnout, GP overload and early retirement, a shortage of doctors and nurses, probably 36,000 nurses short, according to the Royal College of Nursing, in the hospital sector, and over 100,000 out in social care. We're losing staff due to illness and early retirement. Increasingly, we're seeing industrial and possibly more impersonal medicine being practiced. We've seen a decline in mental health in the population and amongst staff. And overwhelmingly, we've seen the impact of social inequality. And this is not new. And Wanless pointed it out, not least in his reports of 2003 and 4. But the Health Foundation's just noted that the global pandemic and the governmental and social response has really brought health inequality into sharp focus. And from the early stages of the pandemic, it was clear that some groups are much higher risk of catching and dying the virus than others. We know age, gender, ethnicity, socioeconomic deprivation, all, of course, much worse since austerity bit. All are important, and they react in interact in very complex ways. So we're looking at a scenario where there are grounds for optimism, but my great concern as a holistic critic of the NHS is that we are in danger of dehumanizing our approaches to both to medical education and to delivery. And unless we can address the staff shortage and the problems that doctors and nurses have, which lead them to early retirement and mental unwellness, I think we're looking at a future for medicine which will make the NHS both financially and humanly unsustainable. Something has to change. We are in crisis and the system is broken.
Thank you, David. Laura Finlay, would you like to make your opening contribution and perhaps reflect a little on what people have said?
Yes, thank you. And I think it's been very interesting hearing what people have said. I'd like to take it, if you like, right from outside and then bring it in. So if we just start at the individual and people at home and the individual and the population, we have an epidemic of obesity. And we have to tackle that head on, because it's very clear that people who are obese do less well when they are sick, and COVID has really shown that. But I can tell you, when I started raising obesity right at the beginning of the pandemic as an issue, it hit almost a brick wall of silence, because it was not deemed politically correct, I think, to raise it as an issue at the time. And we also have to tackle the alcohol epidemic that we've got. And we know alcohol fuels domestic abuse. And we know that domestic abuse fuels child dysfunction, which feeds into child and adolescent and then adult psychiatry and into drugs and self-medication with drugs and so on. So if we don't get that public health end right, our supply chain of health disasters will only get greater. It won't lessen. And therefore, we need to have public pressure to accept things like minimum unit pricing. We need to stop alcohol being on sale so easily at supermarket checkouts, which provides temptation for the person who's addicted. They drink at home, they go home, they beat people up. Those people sometimes end up in the ED. A lot of times they're just hidden from sight. Now, in terms of when people are sick at home, we have got to sort out the relationship between health and social care. And with good social care, highly trained, you can keep people at home. If you don't do that, of course, you get out of hours emergency admissions piling up. They all pile into Adrian's ED, as he's explained so clearly. And linked to that, for my own area, which is end-of-life care and people who have long-term chronic conditions, which are getting worse, I feel that we do have to put specialist palliative care, not separate, out in hospices funded by charities which are reliant on fundraising, and some are going to the wall. We have to say, this is mainstream. Everybody should be able to access it. It is a patient's right to access the care that they need, and that actually they shouldn't have anyone behaving as gatekeeper. And we know, for example, there was a paper out this week that some oncologists are reluctant to refer to palliative care because somehow they feel that they're losing control. Here in Cardiff, we've had decades of working completely in parallel. We've got palliative care going down to the ED as well. It works extremely well, and patient care can improve. Adrian is spot on over beds. It is ridiculous that people have thought that if you squeeze beds, somehow you will make community care happen and you will make more day cases happen. Well, you don't. All the evidence is that you don't. And the reason, the fundamental flaw in that thinking, is that community services need highly skilled personnel working in well-managed teams. So you have to have a shift of resources, but you also have to attract, in a way, a different type of person who wants to work out in the community, carrying a lot of responsibility on their own, prepared to take much more balanced risks. And so there has been this risk-averse default of, oh, they'd better send them in to the ED to be checked out or whatever. And of course, Adrian has explained clearly the disasters of that. And whatever community services and day services, we've got to have 24/7 services. We can't have things closing down. And that means that we need a very different working model. The other area now, if we're right inside the services, is, and again, Adrian won't be surprised at me stressing this, the well-being of staff. We cannot expect staff to provide good care if they are not well looked after. I have the privilege of sitting in on an amazing session that his college ran just last week, and I was so impressed at every presentation there. They really are literally at the forefront, and they are moving things forward. And if we don't look after our staff and value them as a really precious commodity, then we can't expect them to treat other people as a precious commodity. You know, if we look at an extreme of an abuse model, those who have been abused become abusers. How can you expect people to be kind and gentle and compassionate if they are being treated as somehow to be pushed around in a system? And the last thing then that I want to flag up that nobody has is we have huge environmental concerns and wastage. We've got to get to recyclable equipment, recyclable things within the NHS. We've got to decrease disposable wastage, decrease use around single-use plastics. And we've got to find the balance between what was the old-fashioned sterilised kit, you know, that came from theatre in those big green theatre sheets. I remember them well, and being helped into green theatre gowns. And now everything is disposable. But of course, that's got huge environmental impacts too. And if we don't look after that environment, we're not even going to have a world to live in. And some of our expenditure is that we're importing loads of this equipment. Well, we've got to start to recycle and become economically independent on the supply chain. And as we're economically independent on the supply chain, we need to be able to capitalize rapidly on innovations that are happening in, particularly in medical devices, such as AI reporting in radiology and so on. We've got to be able to capitalize on that, because that actually can become a good export to the rest of the world and ensure that we are economically viable in order to fund the NHS that we need. So sorry if that's been a bit long, but I try to give a quick overview.
Thank you. Now, we've covered a lot of really important territory there. I want to put a question from Isla Tweed to Adrian, who talked about 85% capacity as a target. Is that enough? And how does that compare with other countries and how they were prepared for the coronavirus pandemic?
Okay, so the 85% capacity, it requires just a little bit of understanding how this has worked out within the NHS. So this is a recording of the number of beds available and occupied at midnight. It seems like a perverse to do it. You'd never say how many desks in Whitehall are occupied at midnight. But the system that we use and has been reported for years is that the number of people in beds at midnight, and that neglects a lot of Richard's patients who get very successful day case surgery, a lot of the same day activity that just gets neglected. So 85% sort of people might say, well, you're saying you're having 15 out of every 100 beds empty within your hospital. Actually, that's what you need, because there will be so much flux during the day. How do we compare to other countries? Well, we have the second least number of beds per 1,000 patients in the EU, except Sweden. The difference is Sweden has really good social care. At any one time, probably about 10 to 15% of people in hospital are medically fit for discharge. They may not have had the piece of paper which caused them a delayed transfer of care, which is running at about 5% in the NHS at the moment. But behind that, for every one person who has been formally recognised as a delayed transfer of care, there are probably another two or three people who could be discharged home if the right social care setup was available. And usually it's not about getting people into care homes. It's usually about making sure that they can go to their own home with some additional support, things like a stair ramp, a rail, making sure there's some way to go to the loo without having to go upstairs.
So all of those things would help to free up capacity. Do you think the UK is well placed in international terms in terms of capacity of beds?
No. So I think we are way behind. Now, there are models about how you use your beds. If you look at international comparisons, it becomes very, really complicated because you'll look at it and go, Japan seems to have millions of beds. But actually, a lot of what they call beds are actually residential care facilities, nursing homes, or even just a bit of assisted living. So compared to European countries, we run our hospitals much hotter and we seem to be tolerant of cancelling elective procedures much more than almost anywhere else in Europe.
That's interesting. And so I wonder if I can bring the question of funding into that, because clearly capacity and funding have an interrelationship. Bill, or do you want to pitch in on that?
Yeah, I would completely agree with everything Adrian said. In fact, another reason that he didn't say that we need 85% capacity only is we've got to clean things in between patients. And that takes time. And if someone's been infected, you've got to have time to clean it. Now, I also think we haven't addressed the fact that the actual estate of the NHS is not fit for purpose. And lots of the buildings that we've got don't have enough space around. And COVID has shown this, that we need to have more space, more ventilation, better laminar flow, better extraction systems from places to avoid nosocomial infection and so on of people in hospital. In terms of the funding model, I don't think you can just throw funding at this. You don't get people working better just because you pay them more. You get them working better and differently because you value their ideas and you value the way they work and you give them freedom to innovate. So there's a whole mindset that needs to change, I think, as well. And that goes back to what I said really about social care, I think. But it does have to be funded, but it needs capital funding. And the other thing that has often struck me is that, of course, people protest if their local hospital is closing and is moving to somewhere else. And the reason they protest is that they're terrified that they're only losing, not that they're gaining something better. And until we actually put better things in place with more capacity to have step-down beds, flow through and so on, we're not going to get the improvements. And the other group, if I may, that we don't use adequately are friends and family. We don't make it easy for family to come in and help with the care. We don't routinely have rooms in which a family member can stay with somebody to help with a lot of their frontline care. We somehow view it that you take them into hospital and everybody else who knows about them is almost pushed out the way. Now, with my mental capacity hat on, people who've got dementia, learning difficulties, anything like that, the family often know really well how to manage somebody and to help, and they could contribute really well to care if we have a different attitude and involve them in care and don't view them as somehow taking time away or somehow a high risk. But that probably needs our whole indemnity model to change as well, so that we can include people much more in caring for somebody who they know really well.
Thank you. I want to bring David in on this point, because we've talked about the relationship between funding and capacity, but of course the other, there's money in, but there's also people in. David, do you want to say a bit about how you think we might keep people out of hospital from the perspective of former GP?
Well, we've touched on this, haven't we? I mean, partly as Baroness Finley says, if you want whole person care, you need to treat doctors and nurses as whole people. And that's very difficult in a very overstretched, understaffed system. But I want to change the emphasis a little bit into primary care, because we can see that there's it's been said, an epidemic of overdiagnosis and overtreatment. And that's not least because in a very high pressure, rather industrialized form of general practice that's struggling to meet demand, you need so often to turn ordinary human suffering into something that's got a medical label. It can't be for any other than that reason, I think, that we have such a huge number of antidepressants prescribed. And so what are the answers for that? Well, clearly more GPs, but not more GPs just doing the same. If you look at some of the interesting social models of extended primary care now, whether it's James Fernley in Burnley or it's Sam Everington in Bromley by Bow, you can see the ways in which general practices become community hubs. And so we do engage the family, and we do begin to use social prescribing and use altruism and charitable sector to provide some of the things that really are not medical, but have huge contributions to make towards health and well-being and mental health. And we have an epidemic of loneliness, and we know loneliness is probably as harmful as smoking 15 cigarettes a day, according to some research. And we know that human beings are wired for altruism. Baroness Finley mentioned better spaces in hospitals. We know that when you can see green space, or even see outside of your hospital ward, you're likely to stay in hospital for a shorter length of time. We know that urban green space has an impact on community well-being. There are so many ways in which primary care needs more than just medical practice and medical labelling and medical treatment. We do need some sort of political shift, I believe, because we need to localise. I'm sure we need to localise. And if we gave people a better sense of community, and indeed medical practices contribute hugely to that. And the NHS, I think, is a huge signifier of human care for one another. If we can bring these things together, I believe there will genuinely be care in the community, because there will be care and there will be community. At the moment, where these are powerful words, and it's quite clear. You cut the hospital beds doesn't create care in the community. But we need, and in order to do all this, I think we need different forms of education. We are educating people to be specialists. We're educating people who've been academically pruned and grown for a university career, and we turn them into doctors. And I'm not sure that's the best way. We need emotionally intelligent people out there in the community who can be facilitators and change agents as much as they can be prescribers and referrers. And I like to see Sam Everington's ideas about different forms of education for primary care practitioners come into the forefront of our ideas about how to change medical education before too long. Otherwise, we won't have capacity to deal with what's coming.
Thank you. Richard, I wondered if you want to add to that from a surgical perspective about the well-being of patients before they come in for operations. And then I also want to come on to put a question to you, Richard, from Alex A, who's talking about outsourcing of services. But did you want to add on the well-being point first?
Yes, as I said when I made some opening comments, I think that there is very good evidence that the preparation of patients in terms of coming in for a surgical procedure is so important if we're to look at not only the outcome from that surgical procedure, but also the potential complications that they might develop as a consequence of it. And I think there has been a huge focus on the surgical event and not nearly enough focus on the preoperative care of patients and indeed the postoperative care of patients. So I think that we do need to change that emphasis, but if we can develop that relationship between secondary and tertiary care, and indeed primary care with, as David Peters has described, the care in the community of patients, then I think that it will bring huge benefits. It may even reduce the need for some of these surgical procedures to be undertaken in the first place, which can only be a good thing. The more people we can keep away from going under the knife, actually, that's a good thing, really. The other area you wanted me to just comment on?
Well, actually, before we move on to that, I want to just add a question in from Baroness Masham of Ilton, who's she submitted a question by email, which I think you might be able to pick up on, Richard, where she asks, where patients are now having to travel with their rare conditions because the specialised hospital they usually go to isn't available because of lockdown, do you think that surgeons are getting access to enough information about their patients where patients have had to move around?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think the first and perhaps the most important thing that happens between a patient and a doctor is time to have that interaction between the two of them, to understand the particular problem that the patient might have, their expectations from the treatment that they may or may not undergo, and obviously looking at the follow-up care there afterwards. Now, we are all squeezed for time enormously. If you look back to pre-COVID days, then the amount of time you actually get to see a patient in the outpatient clinic can be very limited, can be very restricted. And certainly in my own field, to counsel a patient who has, for example, a brain tumour, actually, you can't do it in 10 or 15 minutes. It just doesn't work. You need more time. You need time to see them again, perhaps a second time and a third time before we get to any sort of surgical intervention. And the system doesn't really allow that in the way that it needs to. Now, clearly, over COVID, we've moved to a system of virtual communication. And I think it's been amazing how we've adapted to that. And I can certainly see models in the future of hybrid models where we do see patients in the outpatient clinic for face-to-face conversations to establish that communication, that rapport, that hopefully we can then follow through in a virtual space. But I do think that communication is so important. Now, clearly, if you're seeing people who have been looked after in other areas, having access to their medical records and so on is all important. And actually, we don't work in a joined up system at the moment. So, for example, if I'm working in outpatients and seeing a patient from another city, another town, it's very unlikely that I'm going to be able to get electronic access to their notes or their imaging because of the disjointed system that we work within, the disjointed data system that we work within. And I think that integrated data will be all important. And I emphasize the need for data analysis earlier on. The reason why we need integrated access to data and data analysis is to move toward personalized care. And it's only if we can analyze those large data sets will we ever get down to being able to suggest personalization of care in the way that we would want to. So I have concerns about it. I think there are ways round it, looking after patients from other towns, but it takes time.
Thank you, Richard. Adrian, I can see you nodding there, and I thought if you want to pick up on that, absolutely do, but perhaps I can put to you first Alex A's question about the outsourcing of services. He says, outsourcing of services, for example, dialysis, diagnostics, surgical waiting list initiatives, to name a few, is a growing practice in the NHS, and this diverts funding and training. Do the panellists see that as the future for the NHS, more outsourcing, more involvement of the independent sector, or is a, I assume that the kind of implication of the question, or is a greater state-run model more appropriate?
I think it's difficult. I think the experience we've learned through outsourcing stuff to various private providers is they're very keen to take on the easy cases, and they're very keen to take on the low acuity necessary stuff that still needs doing and is still important and still provides patient benefit. But the end result is that this, when things go wrong, there's often inadequate governance about so the patient can have a procedure which goes wrong. And, you know, sometimes these patients pitch up in my department in a complete pickle with nobody being responsible for them. So I think there is a question about the oversight. And I think one of the things that the NHS has to do is if it's going to outsource, that's fine. But they also need to performance manage. It's not just enough to sign a contract and say, go away and get on with it. And I think this is the one of the problems we've had with this process. I think we have to be careful about the benefits of outsourcing. I think there is absolutely some value in it, but it needs to be monitored properly. It needs to make sure that people get the care that they need when complications happen. And it means not to have an impact on a service which may not be viable doing the right number of cases.
Thank you. Laura, do you want to pick up on that point?
Yeah, I completely agree with Adrian's points, because outsourcing is fine for a distinct job to be done. But when it goes wrong, it goes even more wrong, because the person ends up coming in often as an emergency, may need ICU, and the very people who've been involved in the care aren't there. So you not only do you end up with the problems, if you like, being dumped on the NHS, but you don't have the continuity either. So and one of the problems with outsourcing is that loss of continuity of care. And I fear in modern day general practice, and in fact in most services, we have lost continuity of care. Now, it never was brilliantly provided by doctors, but it was provided by nursing staff, and it is provided in the community by carers who go in. And they go in and they spot somebody doesn't look quite so well today. They take them to the toilet and they spot that their urine's a little bit smelly. Something has changed. Their walking isn't quite so good. Those early warning signs at the moment are being left to accumulate. And if this is somebody who's outsourced, often the the provider of whatever that service is has a threshold, because they have a disincentive to refer on to the next stage to bring in other people. So it's absolutely essential that outcomes are monitored, but also that the flow between the organisations is monitored, and that they have shared things like shared note systems and things get transferred. The worst thing of all is to have a patient transferred from one provider to another without every bit of contemporaneous information going with them and without an adequate handover. Because if that doesn't happen, you're going to probably have a disaster. You stack up the likelihood of a disaster. And one of the difficulties at the moment is when the disaster then happens back in the NHS, it's very complicated to track back to find the origins of it. And the NHS often gets blamed.
Alex, can I just come in here as well?
Yes, do. Perhaps on the Paterson agenda.
I think this is fascinating, and there has been a move to try to amalgamate wait lists, particularly between clinicians who perhaps have different length of wait lists. And it goes back to the point I was making earlier on, that when you are seeing a patient, and certainly in my world as a neurosurgeon, but every other clinician, I think, you develop a rapport with that patient, and you come to a decision over time about the treatment that that patient may have. Part of that is the patient understanding your perspective as a clinician in terms of what you think you can achieve for them. Part of that also is the patient developing a trust in you as a clinician that's going to provide treatment for them, a trust in the decision making. And I think if a patient is coming into hospital particularly for an invasive procedure to be done, that trust between the patient and the surgeon or the clinician is oh so important. And it's particularly important if things go wrong at the end of it. And unfortunately, things do go wrong. So I've always found it incredibly difficult to function within a shared waiting list space, because the conversations that I've had with that patient to get to that point where they have said, yes, they want to go ahead, are something that is very personal to them and to me as a clinician. And for me to be asked to operate on a patient that I've never seen, I haven't had those conversations, is something that I would would refuse to do unless I have the opportunity to have those discussions with the patient. So I, and this is the same with outsourcing, it's just moving patients into a different environment to get them through, to sort out the wait list.
I want to bring David in. Is there a trade-off, Richard, between that kind of personal interaction and the simple business of cracking through what are now very, very long waiting lists?
I think if you're going to, I understand the wait list. I absolutely understand that. And there are situations, I think, where things like that work very well. So, for example, cataract surgery. And I think you can get to a system whereby it's such a universal procedure. It's such a procedure that is recognized. Hernia surgery, for example. And I think you can get systems whereby you can move patients through very quickly with those sorts of disorders. But when it comes to other things, like for me, brain tumors or operating on aneurysms or what have you, that isn't something that you can just amalgamate a waitlist for. It doesn't work.
Thank you. David, you've been waiting to come in.
Well, only because it's really good to hear Richard say what he said about this human dimension of every kind of specialty. If there is not time, if there is not familiarity, if there's not some empathic potential, because people know each other and know that who I am matters as a patient and who I am as a doctor matters, then you've got a recipe for something which is going to become robotic. And not only that, but when there is a loss of empathy, there is often a greater tendency to complain, and there's often a greater error rate. So industrialization really is, it's one response to demand management, but unless we can stop people falling in the water and concentrate less of our resources on getting people out of the water when they're already drowning, that we are going to just always be fighting off the crocodile, sorry, many mixed metaphors here, without really draining the swamp. We have to do something which will allow us to reduce demand. And those things, as we've all said, have to do with the circumstances that people come to us with. And in times of austerity, social inequality, poor early years experiences, environmental deterioration, we're going to be really pushing the NHS uphill. But if we can improve education and improve staffing levels so that we can be as human as Richard says we must be, then we have a chance of coming through this.
Laura, you've been waiting to come in. I think that we've sort of heard part of the answer to Olivia Marsh's question about how the public and private sector can work together, which sounds to me from the contributions that we've had that, you know, it's a sort of horses for courses. There are certain things where this is part of the answer, but there are other procedures, other treatments that need that personal care where simply outsourcing doesn't work. Is that your sense of it, Laura?
I actually wanted to come back to something Richard said over building up that relationship. And that is that it isn't time on the clock. There's quite a lot of research that shows that it is perceived time. So the patient who has the undivided attention of a clinician may rapidly feel that person is listening to me and I can trust them. Yeah. You could spend hours with somebody who really isn't listening properly with undivided attention, and you will not build up that relationship. But that relationship is extremely precious, and it is in itself therapeutic. So I'm back to saying you've got to look after the staff. You can't expect the staff to have that emotional reserve if you don't look after them. Now, it also means that if you are transferring them from one group to another, you need to be transferring the person to somebody who is named, who you know how they will respond. Sending them into an outsourced pool, I think, is a disaster, because it becomes a lottery and they feel as if it's a bit like snakes and ladders. They've gone whizzing back down to the beginning again, and they've got to start building. So that continuity that Richard's talking about providing. You have the discussion and the patient and you agree that then that procedure will go ahead. That might take a long time. That might be very rapid. I'm thinking about some patients I've had referred to me, very distressed. And within half an hour, we've moved from that to them saying, I never believed that anyone could sort out my problem. Because it's just been undivided attention and a real focus. So it isn't time on the clock. It's about the way that you behave as well as how you work. The other worry I have is that outsourcing has been driven by the pound sign without looking at whether it is actually a false economy and false saving.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, look, I just want to squeeze, we've got five more minutes. So just I want to squeeze in a question from Esme to Professor Peters. You talked, David, about the number of antidepressants being prescribed. Do you have any sense about the prospect for psychedelic medicines to become part of the answer in future? This is now a growth industry. It's not, nothing has yet, I think, been licensed, but this is beginning to be posited as part of what may be an answer to some problems in the mental health space. Is it something that you've come across, David?
Well, I've come across it. I mean, there's a booming research literature now around the psychedelics and some spectacular results in recalcitrant depression. But interestingly, I believe even in those almost miraculous cures, there is a relapse after 3 months, and so new ideas are coming forward. But yes, I think that there is potentially a psychiatric revolution here. But I think it's much too early to say. And I wonder if Big Pharma will take an interest in this and it will become commercialized and commodified. And I can't help thinking that will shoot this whole initiative in the foot. But it's obviously a burgeoning area of interest. I know Imperial has a big program, and I think so does UC. And I've heard some spectacular results, but I think the jury's clearly out. But once again, you know, we reach for magical solutions, and I do say we have to be asking, what are the precursors of all these issues, mental health and otherwise? And I go back to what's been said, both by Baroness Finlay and Richard, and Adrian. In order to develop trust, we need human relationships. And especially now in primary care, when people are not seeing a doctor they know, and they're again and again going back down that snake, they're being over-investigated and often over-referred. And this is having a huge effect on resource use. We need, I think, to get back to this much more personalized medicine, not just biologically personalized, but human to human. I think everyone's asking for that on this panel.
Thank you, David. I think that's a really good note, perhaps, on which to end, the sense that the future of healthcare is about greater capacity, as Adrian has spelt out. But as all of you have said, it's not capacity just to churn people through the system and bring down waiting lists, but to build proper relationships with people between clinician and patient so that we can really care for them as people and anticipate their care needs, much as Richard's report from the Commission for Future Surgery talks about as well. I want to thank all of you for taking part and our audience too. You can find out more about Higginson Strategy and our expert bureau at higginsonstrategy.com. And I wish you all a very good afternoon. Thank you.